Is that good? Ooh. Okay. I was wondering why none of you laughed. It wasn't because the joke was bad. It was the mic. My mic isn't on a lot, apparently. Yeah. It's great to see all of you here. It's really, really good to see all of you, and happy Father's Day, and all of that. If you've been with us, you'll know that we're in the middle of a series right now. We're walking through the book of Philippians, and where last we left off, Paul was sitting in a dark, mildewy prison in either Rome or Ephesus. He's sitting in a hopeless position in the middle of his ministry career, and we're asking ourselves as we walk through the book of Philippians, man, where does he get his hope? Where does he get his peace? Where does he get his joy? Because his letter is infused with it. He's so optimistic, and he has no reason to be, seemingly. And last week, what we sort of landed on was that his hope, his peace, and his joy, the joy that we can have, comes from his understanding of the gospel. The gospel is a righteousness. The idea that he gets his righteousness, his right relationship with God, from the gospel. It's not from anything that he does. It's from the sacrifice and the life of Jesus. And this week, what we're going to do, and throughout this series, we're going to be building off of this idea, and what we're going to find is that Paul's peace and his joy comes from his interpretation of the gospel in a lot of different facets of his life. And so we're going to be building off of last week and working our way out as the month goes on. And this week, we've landed on the gospel as sufficiency. The gospel as sufficiency, or the gospel as contentment, is where we're going to be at. And so if you would turn over to Philippians chapter 4, and I'm going to start reading here in verse 10. I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at length you have revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. And he's talking here about the fact that likely the Philippian church has been sending him care packages of sorts to his prison here. They're sending him things. They know that he's in jail. And then in verse 11, not that I'm speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. The image that we have here in the book of Philippians, and particularly in this verse, is a picture of strength, isn't it? It's a picture of strength. It's a picture of fortitude. As Paul is dealing with this difficult circumstance and he's content, but it's an image that's maybe a little bit difficult to wrestle with. And so this morning as we go, what we're going to be talking about is just different aspects of contentment. First of all, that contentment is countercultural, that contentment is learned, and finally that contentment comes through an understanding of our relationship with Christ. So first of all, contentment is countercultural. This picture of strength that we find here in the book of Philippians, it's compelling, isn't it? It's a picture of strength. It's a picture of fortitude. In Philippians chapter 1, we see something very similar, where we see Paul sitting in prison, and there in verse 1, he says, I want you to know, brothers, that actually what has happened to me, it's really served to advance the gospel, right? We see a Paul here who's optimistic in difficult circumstances, who's sitting here wasting days and months and possibly years of his life sitting in this prison, and he's optimistic. He says, this has really served to advance the gospel. This is a good thing. It's a very interesting image of Paul that we see here, but I think it's an image and a picture that we are maybe inclined to turn away from, or maybe that it's difficult to look at. And what do I mean by that? Well, I think we live in a society that teaches us to never surrender, right? That teaches us to never settle and to never be content. A few years ago, a lot of years ago now, because I think I was like a freshman in high school when this happened, but there was a great musical that came out, and if you can believe it, there was a great musical that came out, Hamilton. You all remember Hamilton? Some of you are nodding your head. Yeah, some people remember Hamilton. It's a musical that follows the life of Alexander Hamilton in song form. So it's great. And there's one scene in particular, because Hamilton is depicted as this sort of prototypical American figure, right? He's hungry, he's ambitious, right? He's never content. And there's a song in a particular scene in this musical called Satisfied, or Unsatisfied is the idea. And there are a lot of different things and innuendos going on here, but essentially Hamilton has met this woman, and one of the first things that he says to her is, you know, like, I'm Alexander Hamilton, and I'm never satisfied, right? There are a million things I haven't done, and you can finish in the rest, but I'm never satisfied, right? And essentially what he's telling her in this moment is, my name is Alexander Hamilton, and I will never be happy with anything that I have or anything that I've accomplished, right? And the interesting thing about that is that thousands of people saw this musical, and when we were all sitting in our seats and we were watching it, none of us said, yikes, you know, like, never satisfied, like, never satisfied, never content, never had, that sounds miserable. All of us said, what a guy, right? We love this image, right? It's never satisfied, never content, always hungry, always pursuing something else. And we wonder why, after living in this sort of environment, we wonder why we're never satisfied or never content. We wonder why we have to have everything just how we want it, or just perfect for us to be happy, for us to be content. And because we have these sorts of figures in our lives, why we have to have everything perfect in order to be happy. And I'll tell you, as people who live in an imperfect world, that's a really precarious situation to be in, to have to have everything perfect, to have everything how you want it, in order to be happy and in order to be content. And so, first of all, when we see Paul's optimism here and his satisfaction, his contentment, and then we hear some of the things that he says throughout Philippians and throughout his letters, for instance, in chapter 2 and verse 14, when he says, do all things without grumbling or disputing, right? I think we're inclined to turn away from that. And why? Why do we complain? Why do we grumble? Why are we never happy and why are we never content? And I say we, I mean mostly me probably, but maybe you too. I was thinking about this week, and I landed on two reasons, and maybe you can relate to these. First of all, I think we are inclined to complain about our circumstances, and to grumble, and to be unsatisfied, and to be unhappy, and to be discontent, because it signals something about our worth, about our value, doesn't it? Right? I deserve better than this, right? When you get, like, when you get a small raise instead of a big raise, it's, I can't believe I've been slighted personally, right? I deserve a bigger house and a nicer car, right? Like, I'm worth that, right? And we complain about our circumstances, whatever they are, because it signals something about our worth and our value. And this is just things that I've noticed from my own life. I don't have anything else in mind here. But second of all, when I think about the reasons why I complain and why I grumble and why I've been generally discontent at points in my life with my life circumstances, I think it's because we tend to believe that it's the only way that we'll ever get anything out of our life, right? We're bargaining, right? Have you ever haggled? You ever, like, gone and bought a car or something like that, and you do the, like, it doesn't just have, like, a price tag. You have to do, like, the exchange, and so you say, I want this car for free, right? And they say, we want everything, and then you kind of meet in the middle. And that's what we do with life, right? We expect life to give us absolutely nothing, and so we ask for everything, right, and hope that we'll get something. And every day that we get a little bit more, we're not satisfied with that compromise, right? We need just a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. Right? The squeaky wheel gets the grease, right? And we want that grease. It's where we're at. And so when we look at Paul here, in his dark, lonely, mildewy, dank, miserable, hopeless prison, and we see him content, and we see him happy, I think we're inclined not to see strength, but we see a chump, right? We see somebody who's settled. We see somebody who's satisfied. And I think we shouldn't, and we'll be making that argument this morning. We're going to return here in a few minutes to those reasons why I, at least, grumble and complain, and the reasons why I feel discontentment at times, and maybe you do too. But before we do that, I think we need to focus on one other thing here, and that is that contentment is learned. Contentment is learned. This is absolutely huge. Look in verse 11. He says, "Not that I'm speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content." Now notice what he doesn't say, because he doesn't say what I would say. Because what I would say, if I was sitting in this Roman prison and I was writing to a friend and I wanted them to feel optimistic, is I would say, things are pretty miserable here. Things are pretty bleak. I'm like, chained up next to people that I don't particularly care for, and it's very dark, and I feel like I'm wasting my life. But I have a window, And if I, if I sit up straight and on just the right day, there's a breeze that comes in and it's very nice. I would point to something in my environment and say, as long as I have a window, right, everything's good. As long as I have something, it's okay. But Paul doesn't do that. He doesn't say, it's all great because I have this or this or this. Because for Paul, contentment is learned. It's not conditional. And that would be the problem with pointing to something. And this is absolutely huge. And almost none of us believe this. I'll just say in maybe a blanket statement. Almost none of us believe that contentment is learned and not conditional. Because I would say, I think most of us believe that if we just lived, in a slightly bigger house, that then we would be content, or in a slightly better neighborhood, or if we just had a slightly better job, or a slightly larger salary, or a slightly newer, nicer car, or if we just sang slightly newer songs, right? Or if we would just stop singing slightly newer songs, right? Then we would be okay. If we could just get this next little thing, that we would be content. I think most of us believe that. I see myself acting in ways that shows that I believe that. And it's huge that's not the case, that contentment is learned. And that's big because there are a couple problems with living as if contentment were conditional. Now, the first one is, when we live as though contentment is conditional, we're never quite happy, are we? And we're never quite happy because we're constantly stuck in the future. We're constantly drooling over things that don't exist yet. We're constantly looking ahead and saying, if only I had, if only I had, if only I had, right? If only things were this way, arranged this way, how I like them, then I could be content. And that causes us to miss really large portions of our lives, I think. And the other problem with this, and I've noticed this in my own life, is that when we live in this way, when we finally get those things, our victories feel really hollow, don't they? Right? Because I've done stuff like this before, where I would complain about my job at FedEx, that I didn't like, and then I'd complain to my family and everything like that, and I was really discontent with where I was at, and then I finally got that promotion, right? But it felt hollow. Because deep down, I knew, and my family knew, and I knew that my family knew, that I would be complaining about that job in 2 weeks, right? Because I complained about everything, right? And that's really, really defeating, right? It's a problem. And now, before we move on here, I want to make just one point here. This doesn't mean, because we'll get to here in a second. This doesn't mean that we should never, that we should stop applying for those promotions, and that we should stop asking for raises, and that we should not live in bigger houses, or we should never get another car, or that we shouldn't advocate for the changes that we want to see, that we believe in, that we want to see here in our congregational life. This doesn't mean that we shouldn't do those things, but it does mean that we should adopt the disposition that Paul has here in the meantime. Right? that when change hasn't occurred, when we haven't gotten what we want, that we should have this the same sort of disposition that Paul has here, the disposition that this just sort of looks at things and looks for the good in things, right? That looks for the ways in which the gospel is being advanced, even in his situation, right? That we should learn to be happy. And I think this is really a blessing when we come to think of it, that contentment is learned, because this means, and we'll wrap up this point here, that this means that all of us, we can be happy this afternoon, right? Isn't that great? There's no sort of like baseline thing that we need in order to be content, in order to be satisfied, in order to be happy, that it's something that we learn to do, which means we can learn to do it, right? There's no sort of requirement, right, in this way. There's no, you don't have to be rich, you don't have to have the job that you want, you don't have to have fill in the blank in order to experience Paul's peace and his joy and his rest here. And that's a huge blessing. It's a huge blessing. We can all be happy this afternoon, and I expect us to be if you show up here this evening. The question is, though, how do we learn it? If contentment is learned, how do we learn it? Where does it come from? And here it'll be important for us to know that contentment is found in Christ. Look at verse 13. This will be a familiar verse to you. I can do all things through Christ, or through him who strengthens me. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. And what does this mean? It means two things. First of all, it means that contentment is strength, right? And this is an important thing to note. A few years ago, I took a theories of religion class at MSU as part of my master's work. And you take this theories of religion class, and essentially what you're doing is you're hearing all of these people and their opinions on what religion is. And there's one that's probably familiar to you, and it's Karl Marx, right? Who said, religion is the opiate of the masses, right? Religion is the opiate of the masses. That religion is something that, you know, it's for people to make them feel more comfortable. You know, it's there so that people will feel content with their lives and so they won't bother us, you know, important people. But it's really not good for you. That's not what's being presented here. That contentment is a strength, right? And I think it is a strength. It's the strength of being able to deal with every situation, right, that you're thrown into, and to have a sort of, and the word in Greek here, it sort of denotes this the strength that kind of wells up from within, right, that you're not dependent on your circumstances to make you happy, and how could we not see that as a strength? And the second thing about this verse that I think we need to really, really think about is that if we can do all things through Christ or through him who strengthens us, that means that our contentment, that our sufficiency, our ability to be content, it'll be inseparably linked to the good news of Jesus Christ. And I'll give you just a couple of examples here. You remember the reasons that we brought up just a few minutes ago about why we tend to complain, why we tend to be discontent with various aspects of our life. First of all, we said that we complain and we grumble and we're discontent with our lives because it has some sort of bearing on our value, right? That when I complain about my circumstances, it's because, like, I need something to validate my value, right? And you remember Moneyball? Did you ever watch Moneyball? Fantastic movie about a general manager of a baseball team. So it was better than it sounds, but a great movie. And there's a point at the end where our homegrown boy Brad Pitt gets offered, you know, this amazing opportunity to work for the Boston Red Sox, and he's given this like amazing offer and this like huge amount of money, and he goes and he's talking with I don't know what you'd call him, sort of his assistant or whatever, and he's asking, you know, should I take this job? What should I do? And the assistant says, you know, it's not about the money, It's about what the money says, right? That I'm worth it, right? And so sometimes we complain about our circumstances because that we feel like they say something about us, right? That it sort of validates us. But the question is, when we look at the good news of Jesus Christ, what could validate our worth more than knowing that our God, that the creator of the universe, has lived for us and that he died for us in order to bring us closer to himself? And if you're sitting there in your pew and you're rolling your eyes at this, I don't think you've grasped the weight of sort of the truth of that story. Right? I mean really. The truth that our God has lived for us, that he came to earth and walked as a man, and that he died for you and me, and that he was brought back from the dead. Right? And that this means that we have a life that extends beyond our own, and this means that we can have a nearness with our Creator, right? And what if we lived like we believed that, right? What would it look like to live tomorrow as if you really believed in that story? Because I believe in that story. And I hope you do too. What if we lived as though we knew that we had a life that extended beyond this one? And what if we lived in a way that showed other people that we knew that we were ultimately valued by the Creator of the universe? And that none of our loved ones who have passed are really gone, but that we'll see them again. Like, what kind of life does this create? It's the life that Paul is living here, a life of peace, a life of joy, right? How else does the gospel answer this? The second thing that we said is that we complain and we're discontent with our circumstances at times because it's we believe it's the only way that we'll get anything out of life, that we're bargaining with life, that we have to, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, right? We have to be dissatisfied in order to gain more and more and more. But I think if we allow the gospel to answer that question, I think it will. Because Jesus' entire life, and in a good portion of the Bible, points to the fact that our God makes a point to acknowledge to acknowledge the humble. Right? And we see this in the Beatitudes in the beginning of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, when he says, "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the world." We see it in the people that Jesus touched on a daily basis in his life, that he ministered to the nobodies, right? We see it here as well in Philippians chapter 4. I don't know if you've probably noticed this before, but look down in verse 22. Do you see this little wink that happens here? It's fantastic. In verse 21, he says, "Greet every saint in Christ Jesus. The brothers who are with me greet you." And then he says, "All the saints greet you, especially those of Caesar's household." Especially those of Caesar's household. Paul is sitting in prison. He's ostensibly wasting years of his life. He's content with his circumstances. And what does this bring about? That he is making the good news known to people of Caesar's household. That's enormous. That's a life of impact. And we wouldn't expect it to be. It's a life of impact. We'll end here. I have one thing to show you here. I think this wraps up sort of this last point very well. This is a picture called Landscape with the Fall of Icarus. Landscape with the Fall of Icarus. I have an art wall in my office where I print off pictures on the paper and I tape it up on the wall, and it helps break up the beige a little bit, and the truths of these paintings are terrific. So let me just explain to you what's happening in this picture. You all know the story of Icarus. Icarus, he's given these sort of like mechanical wings, and he's told by his father, don't fly too low because then people will see you, you'll hit the mountains, but don't fly too high either because the sun will melt your wings and that's not good. And as a young man, what he does, of course, is he doesn't listen to his father, and he flies too high. And so his wings melt and he tumbles to the earth. He's not content with flying just here. He has to get more and more and more, and he has to get higher and higher and higher, and eventually he gets scorched. But the interesting thing about this painting is that Icarus is right there in the bottom right. Do you see his legs kind of kicking out of the ocean? You see him there? I wish I had a pointer. The bottom right, just below the ship, you see two little legs kicking out of the ocean. And the interesting thing about this painting is that Icarus isn't the focal point. In fact, you barely notice him, and it takes a second to really find him. What's the focal point of this painting? There are two people. The one person who's quietly focusing on the work at hand, right, and going one step at a time. And the second one, the person right behind him, the person who is paused in the middle of his day as a shepherd, and who's just taking a second to lean on his staff and to just look around a little bit. Yeah, thank you. To lean around, to lean, and to look, and to appreciate life. It's the focal point of this painting. And it didn't have to be. And I think what this sort of illuminates is another thing that Paul talks about in his letters. It's the importance and the magnitude and the impact of the quiet, peaceable life, the quiet, content, satisfied, happy, peaceful, joyful life of contentment. Friends, that's a life that I believe can only be found and can only be lived through the message of the gospel. If this is a life that you want, a life of not only peace and joy, a life of strength and fortitude, but also a life of impact, a life that makes a difference. If that's the kind of life that you want to live, we invite you to put on our Lord and Savior in baptism this morning by coming while we stand and sing.